Your host, research specialist Mae Brussel.
Okay. I'm a little breathless. The news is coming out so fast. It's hard to know what is top in priority for these 45 minutes to share with you, because there's so many names and people. You have to understand the way power merges. The basis of my predictions or my statements is 9 years research into the political assassination of President John Kennedy, who killed him. I read the 26 volumes of the Warren Commission hearings and broke down, by cross-filing those documents in the way I did, I broke down the entire method which the intelligence operation works in the United States, and worked researching the political assassination of Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, and Medgar Evers, and Robert Kennedy. And so here we are at the Watergate. We're going to cover a full cycle in your lifetimes, you people that are listening. The full cycle is going to go from the Watergate to Dallas, as stated in that article I did in The Realist. The paper this morning, the San Jose Mercury, had an article, Nixon May Quit in the Scandal Wake. The newspaper group had a convention in Washington this last weekend. Paul Krasner, editor of The Realist, was there, and nothing was said except the Watergate. Everyone talked about the Watergate. That was the news of Washington, D.C. The consensus is there's no way for Nixon to remain president of the United States. 2 years ago, in 1970, I sent a letter. It was Christmas time, and I didn't feel like sending a Christmas card to my friends. I was very depressed. I was as depressed as Richard Nixon is right now, for the reason that this country was going downhill into a police state, a fascist state. And I, instead of sending Christmas cards, I wrote a small newspaper, which was 8 pages long, dated January 1970. It said, Happy New Year, and I decided I would put my heart into what I thought was coming out in the nation. And I sent a little newspaper on political assassinations in 1970. And there was a column for Richard Nixon, telling him what his life would be like in the future. I'm going to quote that little paper I did then in a minute. There was one about coup d'etat and the overthrowing of the government for the elite bureaucrat who thinks he's very secure. There was a letter blasting all government commissions because the structure of the past ones had been so phony and contrived, or most of them. There was a message to Senator Edward Kennedy. It was just before his Chappaquiddick dunking, which was to follow in the summer. Is there a Democratic Party? I asked, and then there was a message for the Jews, one for the blacks, one for the news media, and I broke down the intelligence operations, one for the hippies, how that they'd be infiltrated, and the intelligence agents would come down on them. And there was one on strange couples, like Governor Claude Kirk of Florida with Ronald Reagan of California, and Spiro Agnew with Robert Lally of the FBI, and Svetlana Stalin working with Marina Oswald, and Pope Paul VI and H.L. Hunt. The little message I had to Richard Nixon in those days was based upon a remark from New York correspondent, New York Times, C. Sulzberger, who said that the first order of business in 1970, when the Congress reconvened, was to clear the U.S. name. He said in quotes, the London Times, saying that the America is in an unhealthy situation that can bring nothing but harm to both the U.S. and their allies, that the country was coming apart, and they said that the United States had to some way get itself together in the eyes of the world, and this was in 1970. And I wrote to Richard Nixon, and I said, the only way to get this country together is to weed out all the people doing assassinations, knowing political assassinations, planning assassinations, who are high up in government positions. And what I said in this letter was, if persons knowing these assassinations or planning those assassinations have high positions in government, and if you do not dance to their tunes, you will join the company of those already murdered. There is no way out of this one, Richard Nixon. Whoever dreamt, after playing all their rules, it could end in this way? I predicted that Nixon would be assassinated, and this espionage squad that was assembled in the White House was about to create martial law and assassinate Richard Nixon. The assassination plans were called off, but Mr. Nixon will be discredited enough to not remain president of the United States. But they don't have to kill him or declare martial law. What has happened since we met last week? Just 1 week since we were together at KLRB. The president has called in General Haig to take over the White House. He's under house arrest, actually. If you study the overthrow of Greece, which I have done, and I'm going into that further in a few minutes, the Greek military junta was possible because they took faceless generals with no background to work their way up into the system that overrode all the faceless colonels, rather, who, that overrode all the generals and the established conservatives in the community and had replaced them with an intelligence agency. Everyone in every department were intelligence agents that were in key positions. And this was what you're seeing in Washington today because they were ready for the martial law between the time of the nomination and the election in 72. Haig jumped over 243 senior offices. He comes right out of the intelligence system of the Pentagon. We're working at a time to get rid of espionage agents, and what you have is super cop guarding the president's door. And I think if you have a pencil, get one and write this down and write to people in Congress now. Write to Sam Ervin. I'm going to give you about four places to write during this program. One, that we are investigating intelligence operations. I'm going into evidence today that this whole espionage operation was a CIA plan to overthrow the government. It's written in my article, The Realist, and every day the information is coming in, fitting in exactly to that little article that I wrote 3 weeks after they were arrested, July the 11th. Mr. Haig was Mr. Kissinger's representative. He came right out of the intelligence department. He was formerly deputy of intelligence for Mr. Kissinger in the National Security Council. He jumped over all these other men, any person that Fort Ord that is in the army or regular army who is not in intelligence must know and recognize that he's being replaced. And in the Navy, and the same way with the Marines, as Mr. Cushman that's in the headlines today that was responsible for the operation against Daniel Ellsberg's medical files, went right from the intelligence agency, deputy director of the CIA intelligence agency, to be head of the Marines. Every person serving the Army, the Navy, the Air Force, the Marines, the traditional West Point graduate, or the person who has worked his way up, is passed over while the military junta stands ready to take over. Mr. Haig is 243 below any senior officers, and he is replaced to be by Mr. Kissinger's side. And then, when the president gets in trouble, whether we had declared martial law, which we're going into now because Washington's in a complete state of crisis, everything's at a standstill there. And if it's in a standstill, be careful, because then your intelligence agencies take over fully. Mr. Haig is standing there. The president is actually under house arrest. The belongings of Mr. Haldeman Ehrlichman are guarded by these men, police agents. They destroyed all the other things we can't see, or carted them away and locked them. They're forging the Pentagon Papers. They're rewriting history. If you want this kind of a government, if you don't want it, resist. And I'm going on to John Conley. I'm going into Agnew. I'm going to talk about resistance before things get too heavy in this country. I'm speaking mainly to a group of young people. The older politicians, the Democrats, the Republicans have compromised themselves. They've sat by, watched these murders take place. We're talking about a resistance of the minorities, blacks, Chicanos, prisoners, youth, people who care about life and human beings are going to have to form a resistance, because Mr. Nixon has done nothing since his speech but to make us into more martial law. He's not going to let anybody testify against him. The rules are coming down tighter. And he was airlifted once more down to the Bahamas, where the big boys operate, we talked about last week, to get his briefing. John Conley's in the White House today. He made a fancy switch. Nobody should allow John Conley in this position until the archives are open on the killing of President John Kennedy. Even though he was shot in the car, and a lot of people ask me on radio programs, wasn't he innocent, or he wouldn't have sat in the car that day. He never expected to be shot. He said, my goodness, they shot us all. That was the first thing he said. John Conley's payoff for being quiet about Dallas, I always said, would become the President of the United States. He's groomed for it. He's ready for it. He's in the White House as we talk right now. Now, John Conley said the American people have gone so far left that he has to bring the country together. He thought John Kennedy was so far left that it should be brought together, that Kennedy should be killed, and therefore we'd be back on the right track. The relationship of Nixon, Conley, and Lyndon Johnson is historically one of being one party, always together, aware of the John Kennedy assassination, holding the power together, and they're right in there. Lyndon has gone his way now, but the others are all in as a team, working as a team. I said last week I would talk about a document I got from the Southwest. It has to do with John Connally and his private island in Jamaica, where the headquarters of the World Nazis reside. And the breakdown for the political assassinations is, I'm going to give you a very quick outline because we have so much to cover. But to understand the assassinations, because we may be going under, and if we have a martial law or a stoppage of information flowing, which we could have, you can keep this in your head and remember you heard it. A man up in Montreal, Canada, planned all of these political assassinations, and he worked under Division 5 of the FBI. And it was a fascist cabal using the Nazis and the fascists from Germany, from England, and the United States that met down in Jamaica. And the funding for this group is called Permandex, a Swiss corporation. If you read Jack Anderson last week, Herbert Kalmbach, President Nixon's private attorney, has a $1 million secret slush fund. Then part of this was alleged to be taken to the Credit Suisse over in Geneva through an agent that he mentioned in the newspaper this week. This Swiss corporation was moved to South Africa when a book, Farewell America, came out and exposed some of it. But there's five branches of people that operate as an espionage team. One is the Solidaris, which were the Russians that were dispossessed when the communists took over, the white Russians that owned the oil and the land, and they moved out of Russia, and a lot of those Russian emigres moved into the Dallas-Fort Worth area, and I learned about them because they were all friends of Lee and Marina Oswald. They were called the Solidaris. The second branch of Permandex was the American Council of Christian Churches, and this has to do with men that are dressed like missionaries that are actually trained assassins. The funding of the money to these espionage groups comes from a lot of extreme right-wing churches, and it is a cover for espionage activity. The third group is the Free Cuba Committee, which involves the Anacostia people that are involved in the Watergate and Nixon's friends down in Florida, B.B. Rebosa, and the whole element that's being written up. It was written up in Sundance Magazine and many articles on the Cuban community. Then there's the syndicate, which is the fourth branch, and that involves the mafia and organized crime, the going from Vegas to California, down through Arizona, into Miami, particularly into the Bahamas, and the security divisions of the space agencies of NASA. Now, that's where Wernher von Braun came over from Nazi Germany and brought with him scientists, but also social scientists and other 500-600 head Nazis and intelligence agents, so that the framework of political assassinations and the men that are still running Washington, the White House today, the Solidaris, the American Council of Church, the Free Cuba Committee, the Syndicate, and Division 5 of NASA, and John Connally is related to all five of these branches in one way or the other. His holdings down in the Bahamas and the Cuban community there, he's been mentioned in many articles, the use of Jack Ruby and the Syndicate in Texas when he was the governor and John Kennedy was killed. The John Connally, who's with the president today, is related to all five branches of this fascist cabal. And it's very important in now that we see how Howard Hunt has admitted doctoring the Pentagon Papers, lying about John Kennedy and his role in killing Diem, and you see an espionage operation open in front of you. It's important, very important, to write to Washington and say, we want General Haig out and we want John Connally out. There's no way for the congressman to weed out the entire espionage government that overthrew the actual two-party system in 1963. There's no way to find out the truth about Watergate unless we get rid of these particular people. General Haig, who comes from an intelligence agency, watching the Watergate, the man who received the benefit of all this, Mr. Nixon in the White House, and screening who sees him or doesn't see him, is like John Mitchell or John Dean investigating the Watergate. It's so extensive, the intelligence operation, that how can an intelligence general of Mr. Kissinger's be guarding the door to the presidency? There were two articles in the paper this week about the intelligence operations. One is that when Howard Hunt's desk was opened up and John Dean took the equipment, it was kept secret all this time. But because the Ellsberg trial and the judge ordered subpoenaed an inventory of what was in the desk, he received the following information. Now, what I'm reading from you is information in the desk of Howard Hunt that was in the White House at the time he was arrested. Now, if Mr. Hunt was trying to work on the Pentagon Papers to see what should not be declassified or should be declassified, he doesn't need all the equipment of an operational agent. Keep in mind, if he's doing paperwork or trying to find leaks of this kind of where Mr. Ellsberg is getting his contacts, ask yourself what kind of equipment he needs. And the giveaway of what he was doing in the White House is the last thing on the list. He had a .25 caliber pistol and ammunition, which all of these operatives, they were all heavily armed, and I did predict that Nixon was going to be killed. He had tear gas canisters. He had two-way microphones and simulated chapstick containers. You can see him in the restaurant, you know, fixing the wax on his lip, and he's really talking on microphones. Instructions for portable radio transmitters, electronic antennas, equipment, interception capability, bugging, camouflage microphones, harnesses for climbing telephone poles, and jack wires for monitoring telephone calls. But this is what he had. He had two maps of Baltimore and Washington, D.C., with circles drawn around the highway intersections. Two maps. And the Washington officials couldn't figure out what those maps were for. Well, I sent a letter right out to Andreas Papandreou, and we're going to talk about him in a minute, the ex-premier, the man who wanted to be premier of Greece, who was kicked out just prior to his elections when martial law took place. I sent him a letter yesterday and said, does this sound familiar? Because the way that Greece was overthrown was that the faceless young colonels had all the communications. They had all the wires and their own radio transmitters, like McCord has had at the White House, and the walkie-talkies that connect to Hunt. They had the radio transmissions, the electronic equipment, radio stations. Everyone else in the nation in Greece was cut off from each other. And then they had the tanks. They figured if they have the communication and the tanks, and they guarded the main arteries of the streets. And that was the way the military junta took over Greece in a palace coup within 24 hours. And in Dallas, Texas, when Lee Harvey Oswald was arrested, there were some maps in his possession. And the police, the news media said, oh, here's maps with these street intersections and also the depository circled and where he worked circled. And they said, see, he's been planning this for a long time. And so the cover story was that Oswald had set a lair to kill President Kennedy. Later, Ruth Payne, the woman that Lee Harvey Oswald's wife lived with and that he visited frequently, admitted that she had circled the maps, and the getaway was very important with the radio transmitters and the cars that got out of Dallas the day that Kennedy was killed. There were radio calls and diversionaries when Martin Luther King was killed in Memphis, Tennessee. The radio is very important to all of these assassinations, and it's important to mark off certain streets and let certain cars get through and block other cars. So Howard Hunt could not just have been working on the Pentagon Papers when he has maps of Maryland and Washington, D.C. with intersections blocked off. The Morning Paper has an article about the Marine General, Mr. General Robert Cushman, Jr., the commandant of the entire Marine Corps, helping with the espionage operations. But it's very important to know that he not only helped with it, but this article reveals that in the White House, Hunt and Liddy, who were supposed to be plumbers, finding out leaks on what Ellsberg were doing, actually had the most expensive electronic equipment that plugged into the intelligence agencies, all intelligence agencies in the United States. The San Francisco Chronicle said that the CIA dealt directly with them and helped them with their clandestine operations inside the United States. They had this dirty tricks department and safe houses that were provided. Howard Hunt set extra houses where they would run to, you know, after their operations, where they changed clothes and put on their disguises. The CIA connection was initiated by Hunt. This is a San Francisco Chronicle today, who had instant telephone communications with that agency and other intelligence agency offices through a highly secured scrambler telephone that he and Liddy ordered installed in their quarters at the executive office building next to the White House. Now, this is the men They refer to them as the plumbers, but I keep going back to the article in The Realist that I wrote that these men were going to create martial law, and they were hiring provocateurs for the conventions in order to round up the radicals. This is the team who had the road maps, the guns, the wire cutters, the microphones, and many, many more things that you're reading about in the news this week. I'm going to quote, for those of you who don't have The Realist, thing that I wrote in July of this year, and then I'm going to play a tape for you, and then we're going to talk about a little further. In July, when the three men were arrested at the Watergate Hotel, I said that 1972 was the most important year in American history because provisions were made to eliminate the Constitution, and the new version of the democratic rights resembled only a fascist dictatorship, that there would be a new cabinet designed by Roy Ash of Litton Industries to trim away all departments except Defense, Treasury, State Department, and the Justice, and that the same people that put Hitler into power revived fascism in Greece, and that they wanted Spyro Agnew as the president. Andreas Papandreou, I put in my article, often compared with John Kennedy, had a good chance of winning the Greek elections in 67, when the U.S. Army, the CIA, and agencies helped with a coup d'etat, and money was channeled into this country and offered to Richard Nixon if he would take Agnew as the vice president. And at the time I wrote this, I spoke of a $10 million secret fund that was put in our hands of our espionage agents, which you see coming in the news every day, to take Spyro Agnew. I stress this now because you're having Agnew and Connally lining up as the team as Richard Nixon gets ready to get out. We have to say to the Watergate investigators, no, they are not good enough for us. You see, in 1968, I said in The Realist, Nixon was offered, through CIA conduit Tom Pappas, the funding he needed for his election. So, and I linked it to the Nazis in Germany and the Nazis that overthrew Greece and the offices that hired agents like Howard Hunt, Mullen Associates, that really wanted Spyro Agnew to become the president. Now, they're getting it in an easy way. If Nixon gets embarrassed enough, they'll say, okay, we're going to have Agnew. The point is that the democratic process was overthrown, and we have to have an election. We can't let him appoint Agnew or Connally for us. We have to have another election and get very busy. But in case we don't get lucky enough to have an election, there's some smart congressmen in Congress aware of what's happening now. But in case we don't have it, what if they declare martial law? I'm going to play a tape that I received from a listener who listens to the radio programs. I got it just a few weeks ago. It's a tape of Andrea Papandreou that was made a year after the Greek military junta had been overthrown. It was taken from a radio station in Stockholm, Sweden, where he was living, and he was pleading for the world to respond and overthrow the military junta that had taken over that country. Now, because I feel that my listeners are fully aware, the ones that have followed this show for many, many, many weeks, of the possibilities of a military junta, you have to think in terms of resistance and alternatives, because I've said that we have been at war for a long time, a civil war in this country, and a war is a bloody game, and the team doesn't give up that easy. So I'm going to play the Papandreou tape where he talks about Spyro Agnew, the need for youth to resist. The older people, they already have them blackmailed and compromised, and the youth, the ones that are not political today, are not marked yet. So listen carefully, and we'll play this, and then I'll comment on a minute. This is Andrei Papandreou speaking in Stockholm in 1968.
It is quite clear, furthermore, that this is a first phase, that there will be more phases in the active resistance of the Greek people against the regime. The desire of the junta to present this as an isolated event, of course, can be understood, for they have claimed heretofore that even though the Greek economy may not be doing well, even though the people may not be with the junta, at least they had offered something to the Greeks. They had offered them peace, law, and order. It is not true.
But with all these arrests, not only the arrests last week, but during last year, can there be a really effective resistance organization left in Greece?
It is a very good question. In fact, most of the political leaders of the past have been incapacitated, or they are known and the movements are followed, or they have been arrested, they are in jails or in concentration camps. It has taken some time to develop a new leadership of younger people, a leadership of people who have not had much role in political life, people who are not known by the police. And this explains in part why the resistance effort has been a bit delayed in its outer indications. But by now we can say that there exists a deep and wide network of resistance in Greece, of people that are not known by the junta, nor by the police authorities, who will be able to strike hard and to make it quite clear to the junta that the Greek people want their freedom and will fight for it no matter what the cost. I, in my travels throughout the Western world, have tried to carry the message to the leaders of government, to the heads of parties, to the countries of the West, that the Greek people had used a lot of wisdom in not engaging immediately in active resistance, which is so costly to a nation, that they wanted to hope that the West, and especially the key countries of the Western Alliance, the Atlantic Alliance, the United States, Great Britain, West Germany, France, would take a clear stand condemning the regime in Greece and isolating it morally, economically, and politically, and militarily. Those warnings have not been heeded. There has been a tendency on the part of governments, and especially of operatives of the Western, of the United States government, to think that resistance in Greece was not likely to take place. I hope that this first explosion in Greece in a long time will be an adequate warning. We hope so. If not, there will be in for many more surprises.
There's not only relations with governments, but also with foreign big companies which are investing in Greece.
Yes, it is so. It is a pity that big international firms consider that a military regime which has been imposed against the will of a people can provide them good business. And there have been some very sad cases. One of them is Lytton, an American firm. The other one is Esso Pappas, a firm which has played even an important role in nominating the Republican vice president for 1968, the elections of 68, a Greek by the name of Agnew. We shall disclose before long the manner in which the Greek junta paid in Nixon's campaign fund on the condition that Agnew be vice president. We shall be able to produce evidence. And I would not be saying this today unless I could. In a very real sense, the Republican vice presidential candidate in the United States is an appointee of Colonel Papadopoulos. And I may hint one thing. The Colonel signed an agreement with Esso for the importation of crude oil in Greece to the tune of $400 million beyond the needs of the Greek economy and at prices far above international prices, so that there would be provided a fund, a lobby fund in the United States for all kinds of malicious purposes. I think this should be of an interest to the American people as well. It is an interesting aspect of the way in which governments are made in some Western countries. And I should like also to mention that I...
Hi. Okay, I think we'll take... Okay, I think we'll take that there. with that cutoff of countries and talk about it some more. There was some more on this tape. I could play a lot of it. There's a lot of comment. But I think we'll just go on and discuss what he's saying there. I think it's quite clear. If you wonder where all this money is coming from that's going into the funding of these espionage agents and these assassinations, each major assassination costs maybe $10 million to effect an assassination. The agent provocateur in Los Angeles, Louis Tackwood, said last year that there was a $10 million fund set out for the martial law alone. That would be the Hunt, the Liddy, Operation Intercept, the White House plumbers you're reading about now. With unlimited money coming in from foreign countries to overthrow our country and select our president, a lot of this information has been available for a long time. Jack Anderson used to write about it, but nobody wanted to open up the archives and find out just why we had to take Spiro Agnew as our vice president, why Greece, or a known fascist country, or a Nazi country, a military dictatorship has to dictate to us. We have a lot of people in America that are brought up and educated in America much finer than Spiro Agnew, and why do those particular interests that are against everything the United States stands for, why do they have the last say to select the president of the United States? And since when do you buy the president of the United States, and how do you buy him? And that's what all this espionage money. People think the Watergate means that five men were caught taking letters out of the Democratic offices at the Watergate Hotel, where the headquarters were, that they went in there and were reading their mail and listening to their telephone conversations. This was an entire espionage operation against every department in the United States, with agents placed in the outside of the military, in the Department of Agriculture, everywhere, you name it. I have a list of 30 different agencies where these operatives are very firmly entrenched and have to all be weeded out. We have Mr. Agnew linked with the military junta. We have Roy Ash of Litton Industries, who was the conduit of funds to overthrow Greece, sitting in the White House. And this is what I want you to do, your homework for this week. Roy Ash has to be confirmed now before the House. The House of Representatives voted that the director and deputy director of the Office of Management and Budget have to be confirmed by the Senate. Now, who are these two men, the deputy director and the director of the Office of Management and Budget? Have you ever heard of it? Do you know what it is? We had a cabinet with all different departments. You can run them down. When the decision was made to have martial law in 1972 and tighten all controls in this country to join the FBI, to the CIA, to get rid of all the cabinets, to do away with the Constitution, the entire control of the federal budget, domestic affairs, was to be moved inside the White House, like the foreign affairs, taken away from the hands of the congressmen, who were practically all sterile and sitting like a bunch of idiots anyway, doing nothing while all their power is being taken away. So Roy Ash of Litton Industries, who makes huge contracts, used to work for Howard Hughes, and huge contracts from submarines with large cost overruns and equipment, electronic equipment, is put into an office to streamline our budget, because everyone likes to think they're saving money. And he's sitting there in a new cabinet position of Office of Management and Budget, and his deputy director is sitting there next to him, a man by the name of Mr. Malik. And the Congress, after Fred Malik, and after Congress reconvened this year, and after the elections, and Nixon says, okay, I'm going to veto all money you passed last year for old age, the blind, medical research, cancer research, OEO, legal opportunity for the poor. I have a list of 70 things that were locked up in domestic welfares and benefits, and pollution, and rivers, and dams, and clean air, you name it. He took it all and said, no, we got to go over this and trim this down. And the military contracts escalate. $8 billion for new kinds of weapons when there's enough to destroy the world 70 times over. So Office of Management Budget was formed by the president. He put Roy Ash, whose background is very questionable and should be investigated, just because he overthrew Greece as a conduit of funds. You heard Papandreou speak. It's written up in many, many books. He's part of a martial law in a country that had a free election. He siphoned the money to overthrow the country, and he's sitting in the White House right now. So after the elections were over and the Watergate started breaking, the House of Representatives had a vote of 229 to 171 to have an appointment to decide whether Mr. Ash and Fred Malik should be, have the approval like cabinet members. They're inside the White House, and the president said, they're going to control all of our money. But they don't have to have your approval. And the House voted, yeah, we want to know who they are. There's a quotation in the paper that the impact and decisions of the office management budget are no less than any member of the cabinet. As long as Congress has no authority at all over these particular two men of the office of management budget or power in the budget area, so long as they will be handicapped in exercising any power over them, they want to have a hearing about who they are. And Mr. Ash thought, well, he could win confirmation. He's been in the public eye for so long. But they want to ask him about his financial problems, and believe me, there are plenty. So there is going before the Senate, and I want you to write to the Senate and about Roy Ash and Fred Malik. Now, the name Malik, you don't know very much. You're reading the name of Ehrlichman, John Ehrlichman, super spy agent, espionage agent in the White House. He is the domestic, in charge of domestic affairs, who works with Roy Ash and Fred Malik. Again, who are these faceless people that come in? And while after the elections and the Watergate thing was stirring, they had Spiro Agnew out in Palm Springs at the time of the Bob Hope, where the Teamsters were meeting and the Mafia and Richard Nixon's airplane, and that group was handled. They had Agnew there, but in the White House they have Roy Ash of Litton Industries. And Roy Ash, at one time, he worked for Howard Hughes, and he took $43 million off the books of Howard Hughes, never accounted for, to start, and he started Litton Industries, and we don't know if we paid that money or if we have an investment in Litton ourselves. We know a lot about Roy Ash. Who's Fred Malik? Fred Malik would be the assistant deputy director of the Office of Management Budget, and you probably never heard his name. He's known in Washington as the Hatchet Man. He's the same ilk and fabric as Haldeman and Ehrlichman, intelligent agent from Green Berets. He's in charge of the graduate of West Point. He went to West Point. I'll give you his background. And he went into the Green Berets in the Army. He went to Harvard Business School like Roy Ash. Roy Ash never graduated from college, but he went to Harvard Business and then went right out to Howard Hughes. They went from the military service, these men, to a particular clique at Harvard Business, then to California to an organization called McKinsey & Company Management Consultant Firm. I wonder if that's a dummy front. I haven't done any research on that yet as a dummy front for espionage agency, but I certainly will look it up for my next article, because I was right about McCord Associates being a dummy front. McKinsey & Company, management consultant firm in Los Angeles. He then went to a tool company where he made tools in South Carolina and was a multimillionaire several times over by the time he was 30. Now, that's very interesting, to get out of the service in his 20s to be in the Green Berets, go to Harvard, be a management consultant, go to South Carolina and have very many million dollars by the time you're 30 years old. At which time he comes to the White House, where they're very impressed. His background is, he quotes, non-political. Typical of espionage agents, they're not necessarily Republicans or Democrats. John Mitchell wasn't registered one or the other at the time he met Richard Nixon. They are independents, in quotes, independents. He's non-political, Mr. Malik. His description is this. He's the hatchet man. He comes in and fires anybody in a heartless way, similar to those faceless men in Greece, and they're proud of the way he does it. He has the reputation of going in when Mr. Hickel from the Department of Interior was fired. He went in the next day, and on one day's notice, he can say, "You're fired." The quotations about him say he doesn't allow himself to think about any guy or the kids or the wife crying or anything. He's good because he doesn't dwell on such manners. He can handle the job. He's our hatchet man. These are quotations from the Washington Post. He's known as tactless, ruthless, lack of emotion or concern for co-workers, victims, or beneficiaries. He's the one who's going to take care of our domestic needs of youth, hippie, black, minority, Chicano, American Indians, and middle America, retired or otherwise, or anyone who doesn't approve of the fascist administration like Mr. Hickel did not approve. He was opposing ideas that were put up for Alaska with Richard Nixon. Out you go. Your whole staff goes out. Malik is a hatchet man. They said, in quotations and articles, that I've never seen him demonstrate a good substantive understanding of what the consequences of his acts will have on people. Now, this isn't a military man taking over Vietnam like our people did with a genocidal war, napalming and burning people together. This is domestic policy. Everything with him is systems, planning, operation, analysis. People are tools of business. This is his friend saying. This is an interview. What is Malik like? People are tools of business. His friends describe him as meticulous, controlled, quiet, persistent, organized, surgical, purposeful, efficient, and ambitious. If this isn't the outline of a Nazi kind of operation, I don't know what is. He would sit in every day with health, education, and welfare, every morning with Henry Kissinger, whose man Mr. Haig guards at White House, with Mr. Ehrlichman and Haldeman. He came in through Mr. Haldeman. And as I say, when Walter Hickel was fired, the Interior Secretary, out went his whole staff one day. Out you go. This Malik is the one who ordered an FBI investigation on Daniel Shore when he was talking about the White House. And when they found out that he was being bugged or followed, they said, well, we wanted to consider an appointment for environment. These are straight espionage agents. We may as well call them what they are. I've been saying it for 9 years and 2 years on the radio, KLRB. I'll give you the descriptions of these people so you recognize them. Another job he has in the White House, Mr. Malik, is to see that the administration policies are carried out in every agency. In other words, in domestic policy, he's to go to every agency. So let's give a sample of Mr. Fred Malik working with the Department of Agriculture. He goes over to see Mr. Butts under the Department of Agriculture, who's making all these wheat deals. He bumps into Mr. Steve King. Now, Steve King is an ex-FBI man who was out at the hotel with Martha Mitchell at the time she called Helen Thomas. He's been promoted to assistant under the Department of Agriculture in charge of hiring over there. He helps weed out requests and transfers and handles the employees and applications from the outside. This is our Department of Agriculture, Domestic Affairs Department. So Mr. Malik visits co-agent Steve King. Steve King could forcibly inject Martha Mitchell, hold her down, silence her, put her to sleep, call secret police. He was not under house arrest. The hotel where they were staying had no responsibility. Former FBI came in. It's a whole private secret army of ex-FBI men like this Wackenhut Corporation in Florida. They call in their whole team. The FBI says, we didn't inject her. We didn't throw her hand through the window. The hotel says, we didn't do it. The private police says, we did it, and they're not arrested for it. Not only are they not arrested, but he is in charge of the Department of Agriculture under Secretary Earl Butts. So when Mr. Malik goes to see the policies that are carried out in the Agriculture Department, he shakes hands with Steve King, co-agent. This is how deep the Watergate's going. The stuff that's happening today with Hunt, Colson, Liddy, you can read, but I'd like to spend our time each week on new names and tell you to write to Congress and talk about that. This particular Mr. Steve King, before he went out to guard Martha Mitchell in California for that weekend, his job in the Senate, this is what his job in Washington was, and see what this sounds like. This is from the Washington Post. His job was an intelligent agent part of a police force. And in the Senate, they said he was a Senate Government Operations Subcommittee on Permanent Investigations. I mean, if this isn't out of Orwell or 1984, Steve King's job was the Senate Government Operations Subcommittee on Permanent Investigations. You see, Mr. Fred LaRue, who's going to be indicted at the Watergate for handing out espionage money, was at the White House for 3 years, had no salary. He was the liaison of John Mitchell to the White House from the Justice Department of the White House. Who paid his salary? Was it that Greek military junta we heard about? Were these part of these $44 million or $400 million it was to coming into this country? The Watergate's going to go on for many, many years unless the president calls it halt and brings in Agnew and Connolly. But the names to watch in the news now are Roy Ash, Fred Malik, write to Congress about them, Connolly and Agnew. Do something about these people. I sound a little upset because I see the best possible world of these people being exposed and crumbling now if the people outside respond accordingly. And I could see a military junta where the president says, we've gone too far, the country is divided, I'll step down like Lyndon Johnson did in 68 in the interest of the country, thereby not being tried for a few alleged assassinations I'd like to see him account for. He'd be very noble by stepping down on the guise of saving the country. Everybody's demanding the truth, and impeachment is about to proceed, or it's been suggested. It was turned down today when Bal Abzug brought it up, but people are waiting for the proper moment. Well, think of Roy Ash and Malik and Steve King and Conley and Agnew, and know that even if they're getting smoked out, we have a lot of work to do. It's the year of the ox, the Chinese year. We've got to do a lot of work to get them really weeded out so we can get this country back to using the energy and the resources and the people, the really beautiful people all out there who have been oppressed by this system for too long. Okay, I'll see you next week, and I know it won't be any more, any better, but we'll calm down. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to Dialogue Conspiracy featuring research specialist Mae Brussels.